Oh, yes, ladies and gentlemen, welcome once again to another edition of The Story Behind the Story. I'm your host, Dr. H. Ruwah. We have a special, special guest once again lined up for you tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, joining us tonight from the Empire State, my good friend and colleague, Dr. Michael Nucitelli, will be joining us. So stay tuned, folks. And if you haven't ever heard Dr. Nucitelli on the show, well, you're in for a really, really great treat tonight. I guarantee you that. And so spread the word. It's a lot of time before we bring on Dr. Nucitelli to the, you know, call your friends and neighbors and tell them to get on and listen to this. It's a must. We live in an incredible wired age. You all know this. You're listening to this radio show today on cyberspace. This has opened up an entirely incredible new frontier. And along with everything that's good, there's a dark side. There's a dark side of the moon, folks. There's a dark side of everything, it seems. And being aware is a battle half won. Okay, so being well aware is important. We're entering new ground. We're absolutely plowing new ground as far as information technology is concerned. And I'm telling you, folks, I'm just so pleased and proud to bring on my good friend and colleague now. I've gotten to know him so well, and we've talked so many times about so many different things. Dr. Michael Nucitelli in New York is a licensed forensic psychiatrist, ladies and gentlemen. He does incredible work, and he above all else has seen the need for some intervention in the field of cyberspace for the very incredible level of what he calls eye predators. And his websites have been extremely helpful for law enforcement, FBI cyber crimes and others to, again, just be able to start a foundation, if you will, a forum to address this very real problem. I've shared his website information, personal information, with a number of law enforcement individuals, many of which are involved in schools, and these law enforcement individuals are just lost because there is. There's such things as assaults on texts, for heaven's sakes, and so many of these high school kids, and especially university kids now, okay, they're all wired. They all have cell phones, it seems. They all have complete access to the computers, and it's a new world. So this is the brave new world of Aldous Huxley and others. We're going to talk about it tonight, how to protect yourself and your loved ones from cyber stalking, cyber bullying, cyber attacks, predators. And there's a whole level of information here I'm sure you're going to find extremely valuable. And again, let me just tell you, folks, Dr. Nucitelli, our guest tonight, will introduce another colleague who will be joining us later on the show and give you her background. Folks, Dr. Nucitelli is doing all of this pro bono, free on his own nickel. There's no charge for what he's putting out. That is just absolutely amazing. I salute him. I tip my hat off to him. So with that introduction, Dr. Michael Nucitelli will be our guest tonight for both hours. Welcome to the show, Dr. Michael. How are you?
Wow. Good evening, Doctor. Thank you for having me on, and good evening to your listeners. And what an appropriate song to open up the show with. Welcome to the Machine, Pink Floyd. How appropriate, if not prophetic, it is to us living in the information age. I mean, obviously the song talks about the band member Syd Barrett back then, but from a metaphorical stance, welcome to the machine, welcome to the information age. And as you mentioned, Aldous Huxley, thank you for having me on. Thank you.
My pleasure. Again, I just thank you for all the work you do, the tireless work. Seems like when I do try and contact you, you're always in consultation. You're in great demand, and that is just going to continue to increase. I wish you could clone yourself a dozen times, maybe. but you know, you got to start somewhere. So again, just thank you. What's new? You know, your odor situation, and I'm talking about your your body smell now.
Well, I know, right? We're going to get to talk. Well, first and foremost, if I may, I just want to give some quick thank yous and shout-outs. And then also we have Dr. Vera, who's going to be calling us shortly. And it's interesting how you say, I wish, you know, you could clone me. I've said that to her probably about five times in the last month because Dr. Vera, and you mentioned on college campuses, well, Dr. Vera, she's the director of faculty and staff assistants for the University of Colorado of Boulder, at Boulder. She's also the chair of the behavioral intervention team, and quite larger than that, she is president-elect of the Colorado Psychological Association. So this evening for your show and both when it's archived, guarantee there are plenty of students, faculty, community members from Colorado. So a big shout out to the University of Colorado Boulder, and Dr. Vera will be coming on shortly, and she will spend a good 45 minutes with us talking about, you know, eye predator and what's going on in college campuses, particularly on hers.
Well, yes, you know, it seems like we're having more and more of these disruptive people bringing guns into the situation, shooting up. A lot of this is happening, of course, in college campuses across the country. But as I talked about this on a monologue, Dr. Mike, a few weeks ago, and exposed, it's not the guns that's the problem. You look at so many of these individuals. In fact, I posted a list that's stunning of all of these the common link is not guns, really. It's these individuals are on some kind of antidepressant medications that have gone out of control. And nobody's wanting to mention that part of it, it seems.
Well, right. And we recently dealt with the UCC shooting a couple of weeks ago, and I did a radio interview with Megan McCain, American Now, and to discuss the UCC shooting. And right after the UCC shooting, what happened is they went all into, the Obama administration, the Republican versus the, everything over, rights to bear arms and gun issues. And what I spoke about, which I believe, and if we look back just from 2011 to this gentleman, Mr. Mercer, 9 or 10 different spree killers, are gun issues something we need to discuss? Yes. Are violent video games something we need to discuss? Yes. Mental illness? Yes. But really, the common theme from Jared Loughner, the Arizona shooter, through Anders Breivik, the Norway mass killer, James Holm, the Colorado shooter who went to one of the Colorado colleges, all the way up to this gentleman, there is a strong information age component where they habitually spend a lot of time in cyberspace. And that's part of what we're going to be talking about is when a regular person or somebody who suffers from a psychological dysfunction, begins to experience first a sense of psychological isolation, then moves into the next step, which spree killers do, which it's theoretical, I believe, is moving into the need for retribution, is having to get back at folks. So we're going to talk about this, this evening, and everything related to the construct of my predator.
Well, indeed. Yeah, I like what you have now, this the acronym ODDOR, order sense, for offline distress dictates online response.
Exactly. Thank you, Doctor. Odor. It's funny how it came. Yes. Offline distress dictates online response. And most of the evening's discussion will be on that. And that is a subtenant of eye predator. In a nutshell, eye predator is 8 typologies and essentially the dark side of cyberspace. Essentially, it is the information age dark side of human consciousness, ranging from the pediatric cyberbully, the cyberstalker, cybercriminal, all the way up to your online sexual predator and cyber terrorist. That is the criminal profiling of information age assailants. But what we're going to be talking about tonight is odor. Yes, offline distress dictates online response. And this applies to all of us, Doctor. It applies to you. It applies to me. It applies to people from the community. Anytime we go into cyberspace, for whatever reason, is our offline world, our perceptions, are whether we're upset, too happy, too sad, directly, which I believe directly influences how we respond in cyberspace. And that is very important for all online users to understand in order to stay safe and not to engage in online risky behavior.
Well, this is a huge, huge topic, Dr. Mike. It truly is. I like some of your quotes. And again, folks that are listening, you can go to the chat room there and follow along with this free PDF paper. Again, go to Dr. Mike's website that's listed there. You can follow along with this, and I strongly recommend to download that free PDF. Print it out. Your quote here, Dr. Mike, I want to just, before we bring Dr. Vera on, or she calls in, this is so, to me, it's so incredible to focus in on. Your quote is, when 80 billion neurons, that's in our brain, folks, and 1 trillion plus neuronal connections in the brain connect to what? The trillions of digital connections in ICT. Okay, the dance between organic and inorganic networks begin. That's profound.
When you thank you, Doctor.
It really is a recipe for some. It's an amazing soup that can come out of this. Do you want to comment on?
Well, one of the things that I study going forward, which we're also hopefully we'll get to approach because I have questions for you, is what I believe, as you and I have discussed in the past, is that I believe, once again, it's all theoretical, is that cyberspace is an extension of human consciousness. And as we walk through society, walk through the information age, they are going to parallel more and more to where they become symbiotic. And I believe on a very rudimentary level, and I'm not talking about AI, artificial intelligence, albeit that's around the corner, is how cyberspace and the human brain are essentially, on a very basic way, kind of like a synapse, communicating with one another.
Well, the machine indeed. Hey, listen, Dr. Mike, Dr. Vera is now online with us. She's connected. Welcome to the story behind the story, Dr. Vera. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us tonight.
Oh, thank you. You are so welcome. And I just want to, first of all, thank you, Dr. Ott and Dr. Nicotelli, for having me and inviting me here tonight. And I also want to welcome the listeners. And, you know, first of all, I just want to say thank you, Dr. Nicotelli.
Oh, you're welcome. And I'm glad to have you on the show. And, you know, if you could tell the listeners and Dr. Ott a little bit about what you do, because obviously you do quite a bit, and I am honored to be, you know, working. Dr. Ott, and to the listeners, Olga, if I may say, Dr. Vera, Olga and I have known each other. It's now going on 30 years, but we haven't spoken since our undergraduate school back at SUNY New Paltz here in New York. 30 years go by. And, you know, 6 months ago, we started chatting again, and here we are now working together on creating new constructs as it relates to the information age. And one last thing, Dr. Vera, because Dr. Vera knows, is we would both like to dedicate this show, our interview, to Dr. Raymond Schwartz. Dr. Schwartz is a PhD psychologist from SUNY New Paltz that both Dr. Vera and I, he was our supervisor when we were kids. So I just want to say God bless Dr. Schwartz. Thank you, Doc.
Oh, Dr. Nicotelli, I am so in agreement with that. You know, it's you and I have worked together after so many years, so many years have passed. And Dr. Ray Schwartz, I just want to say a shout out. You have been, I can say for both of us, clearly, that you have been a mentor and an inspiration to us in the field of psychology. So I just want to say that to you. Here we are today talking about some really critical issues. And I will have to say to you, Michael, Dr. Nicotelli, that you are truly, I'm quite impressed with you. You're truly the Freud of cyber psychology. You know, I have been delving into this area for many years, and have not found anyone who really has had the courage to come forward at this point to really, you know, this is not the future. This is present.
Oh, well, thank you, Dr. Vera. But let's not talk about me. Tell the listeners and Dr. Vera a little bit about yourself and what you do. And by the way, I've already given a big shout-out and plug to the University of Colorado Boulder, because I know you've got a lot of listeners that are listening tonight.
Oh, thank you. Well, I am obviously a licensed psychologist. I've been doing this work for 22 years. I'm the director of our faculty and staff assistance program at the University of Colorado. I also am considered a trauma expert. I've been doing a lot of trauma work for the police department and for individuals and organizations for the last 16 years. And, you know, presently doing a lot of research and work in this area of cyber and trauma and attachment issues. So I am privileged and happy to be here today. And also I am going to be the president of our psychological association here in the state of Colorado.
Congratulations, doctor. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And I'm happy to be here, to talk about some of these critical issues that I see, certainly on our campus. I see it in a variety of settings when it comes to, you know, cyber psychology and the vulnerabilities that certainly our children or adults are struggling with.
Wow, that was a great intro. Don't you think, Dr. Rod?
Well, yeah, I'm just sitting here just letting it roll.
Well, can I ask before we continue, Dr., because I know you only have until 9 o'clock, can I ask Dr. Ott, is she coming through okay on the phone? Because what I'm hearing, she's kind of fading in and out. Is that just my phone?
No, it's on my end too. I'm not sure what the problem is there. It is kind of like a
roll. Is it fading out?
I don't. Sean, what do you suggest there?
Well, it's a phone line. They kind of have a weird interface with Skype. They dip in and out sometimes, but overall, it's definitely understandable.
Okay, great.
Okay, so you can actually hear me. I want to make sure you can hear me here.
Yes, we have to make sure that the world hears Dr. Vera, yes, because she's got a lot to say.
Oh, okay.
Well, so if I may, Doctor, the first question for Olga is, obviously, you have, you work with both the student body, the faculty, you're the chair of the behavioral intervention team. Can we start off by you telling us a little bit about, you know, whether it be cyberbullying, I just use the term high predator, but how kids, college-age students, how they are both positively and negatively affected by cyberspace today?
Sure, I'm happy to talk about that. You know, I'll start with the positive because I like to talk about the positive first. You know, many of our, and I will say teenagers, and I will say young adults, and also our adults, you know, the positive about online connection is that we have the capacity to reach so many of our connections instantly. You know, that's like immediate connection to our loved ones, to our friends, to our social connections, more so than we've ever had in our lifetime. And I will say, I would say that, and I would probably agree with you, Michael, is that we are at the cusp. You know, it's, we were at the stage where online, devices were not available to us, right? And yet we sort of grew up in this world of online devices, and we're seeing our young ones really, really connected to that right now. So one of the positive instant connections, you know, I will say for our parents, in this time of age where there's, you know, a lot of issues happening in our campuses, unfortunately, that they have access to their children immediately. And so there are positives to it. You know, the challenges, of course, are that we are losing the human connection. You're losing, and I hear this. I hear this from my teenagers. We're losing.
What do you hear from your teenagers?
So what I hear is, you know, I'm yearning for contact. I'm yearning for someone that I can see in person. Many of our teenagers, their worlds are online. And so they can create, which I hear all the time, they create all these fantasies and projections and ideas about others and themselves. You know, there's an opportunity to really create your own fantasy out there in the cyber world. And yet, ultimately, what I hear from a lot of our teenagers and adults as well is this disconnection from contact. You know, we are wired as humans. We're wired to love, to connect, and to attune to others. And that means doing it in person. That means eye to eye, brain to brain, contact to contact. And many of our kids, and I hear this all the time, are losing that. Many of our kids are having online sort of relationships where they haven't had that human contact.
Where they're spending their entire lives, yes, with either holding the little black box called the mobile device or sitting at a desktop. It's interesting. But, you know, I mean, me personally, I don't work on a college campus, so you're in the trenches being able to see what, you know, the adolescent and then the young adult is going through on a daily basis. May I ask you, because at University of Colorado Boulder, you know, you have freshmen, which start off, I would say, what, 17 to 18, all the way up through doctoral degrees. So you're dealing with anywhere from 17 to 18 all the way up to mid to late 20s, and I'm assuming, you know, some of your doctoral students are older, like me. Are you seeing any difference in age or gender, or is pretty much across the board everybody is enveloped by information technology kind of stuff to a certain degree?
Well, what I would say based on what I've been seeing, so I will start with our you know, adolescent. What I see right now is many of our adolescents have grown up in just the cyber age. You know, they haven't had as many of us who are in what I would call the bridge between what, you know, before cyber technology, and what it is now. You know, there are different struggles.
Forgive me, it's funny because Dr. Ott and I in the last show, I don't know if you remember, Doc, is that we briefly talked about when him and all three of us, is that when we were children, there was no technology, there was no Facebook. You know, we grew up with walkie-talkies and maybe a CB, you know, and if you were really technologically advanced, it was that ham radio. So we didn't grow up with technology, and when we would meet people, you would meet them, and guess what? You would be looking at them in their eyes. You would be able to, you know, see their nonverbal communication. And now that we live in the information age, children don't have that, and I hate to say it, that luxury of being able to learn interpersonal skills.
Of course, they do not. I'll give you an example of one client, and I'm going to keep it really general here. For the first time, this is someone that I was working with, for the first time, wrote a letter in her lifetime. Her little lifetime was 18 years. And she sent me a letter about how she felt, you know, sort of just her struggles, etc. Long story short, we got to talk about it, and she said, I have never experienced this.
And she said there was something so different about writing a letter and then speaking to you and looking into your eyes.
Wow.
That was so different from my experience with my friends where, you know, and this is a kid, I gotta tell you, this is a kid who has an online relationship with someone in some other state who's struggling with how to have that continuous relationship with someone who she's never had any physical contact with. And so, you know, it gets complicated.
Yes, it does get complicated. Dr. R, I mean, Olga brings up a point. I mean, obviously, now that her and I have been talking and we're going to be working together going forward, both of us have general consensus is that we believe society, not causal, but, correlative, is that information technology, social media, the devices are influencing or encouraging a disconnectedness within society to where we're beginning to disconnect to us. Let me ask you, Doctor, do you feel along those lines or do you see the information age differently?
Oh, I absolutely see that. I just I like to watch people, you know, as we've had this discussion, Dr. Mike, and, you know, and I just like watching going through a mall, for instance, and watching.
I'm sorry, that's hilarious, right?
Thanks,
it's funny to watch them. They're just their thumbs move in rapid fire succession on their texting and their phones. It's almost humorous, but and then again, it's so tragic because these kids have got to be missing the most important part of their brain development, and that's interpersonal, face to face, soul to soul, mind to mind communication. And that if they're not having that, there's going to be I hate to think what it's going to be in 30 years.
Well, can I ask you, if I may, I mean, not to say that, I mean, if you believe in Armageddon or judgment, so be it. I don't know what your dogma is. But what do you see occurring in 30 years? Because that's one of the things I'm trying to help prevent. I just don't see it as good. But when you look into your mind's eye 30 years from now, what do you see if we don't change the trajectory?
I've done a number of radio interviews, Dr. Mike and Dr. Vera, about this very substance. And so thanks for bringing that up. The subject is called transhumanism, where we become so interfaced and wired as humanity as a whole with machines that we become literally a machine, and there's no interface between that. And some people think there's no moral problem with that, that it's all good, that extend the life expectancy of humans to maybe 500 years. But yet there's a moral, deeply spiritual connection that should we even be trying to do that? Okay, so the people leading the charge on this transhumanism, you know, great minds like Dr. Raymond Kurzweil and others, okay, that are leading the charge in Google and R&D and whatever. Their concept is so different. Their worldview is so different because they've been asked this question. What about the issue of God? Is there a spiritual connection to you? Does God exist in your mind, Mr. Kurzweil? And he smiles and laughs and this is chilling to me personally. He says, no, not yet. God does not exist yet. In other words, they're going to be creating a super mind, a supercomputer system called that they'll be able to say is their deity. That's, I think, where we're heading, in answer to your question, Dr. Mike.
Well, and I would like to ask you, if I may, real quickly, is because I would love for you to tell me what, and forgive my ignorance, to say what transhumanism is again, but one of my passions is to study, you know, as I said earlier, is I believe, you know, cyberspace is an extension of human consciousness. The study of human consciousness is called philosophy of mind. So I spend a lot of my time studying human consciousness and all the philosophy that surrounds it, and what they're talking about now now is it's called the soft problem, the hard problem, to when a day will come where the machine, obviously a digital network, welcome to the machine, is that we, humanity, will create a machine, a computer, that will be smarter than us, which they've already done. Wilson on Jeopardy. But essentially what they're talking about, a day will come where a machine will have a consciousness and be smarter than us, and it will think like us. Well, what do we do as humans? We created a machine, a computer, something smarter. So the theory is, what the soft problem is now that machine, that conscious computer now, will create naturally a machine smarter than itself. Once it does that, the question then is, do we need humanity anymore? Because now we're low, we're tertiary on the hierarchy, you know, on the totem pole.
Yeah, that's the debate. That's the danger zone in my mind, Dr. Mike. And I want to get Dr. Vera's take on this too. But yeah, the whole concept of transfusion is a day of what they call singularity. And they're projecting this sometime in the near future, like in 2030, okay, where singularity becomes the point where the machines basically take over human consciousness and becomes indistinguishable, okay? We become machine-based. Now, you follow that through to the genre in the movie theme of science fiction and the Terminator series, okay? You have this Skynet facility that becomes self-aware, and it begins to actually begin to manipulate the time-space continuum, which in the realm of quantum physics is very real, and can then send back to the past certain machines to influence the outcome in the future. That's where it starts to get really, I'm talking to two psychologists here, where it seems like this gets really crazy.
I want to ask Dr. Vera, but you know, really, is, you know, from everything I've studied, is apparently we, not me, because I'm certainly an idiot when it comes to technology. I just know between the ears. But you know, your techies, your people that work in that, are supposedly, what they're estimating is within the next 20 years, they will be able to create a machine, a computer, a digital network framework with consciousness that'll be able to experience consciousness. And that is the beginning within 20 years, which is very interesting. Now, somebody who, and also as well with Olga, both of us, and you know, with you two, is our, I don't want to say curiosity or fascination, not that we enjoy it, but everything I do is the study of the dark side. Dark psychology, which, you know, I put together in 2006, is the, you know, the trying to understand the dark side of human consciousness. iPredator is trying to understand the information age dark side of human consciousness. Well, if we go 20 years down the road and we create a digital framework with consciousness, won't that have to have a dark side as well? Because we, as humans, we learn through trial and behavior, trial, you know, and that is the one piece that I can't find anybody answering right now.
Well, can I chime in here?
Oh, please, Doctor.
Absolutely.
So I will, you know, so the piece that comes to mind for me is, okay, so we have a machine, right? So where's the soul of it? If we're talking about spirituality, which I think is one of the resiliency, if we talk about resiliency, or we talk about people's vulnerabilities when they go online, part of it is the capacity to know that there's something bigger than we are. Right? How does a machine do that? If we're losing that, we're also losing our capacity to, are we saying that ultimately we don't believe in something that's bigger than we are? Because
is that a rhetorical question?
One of our,
Dr. Just,
you know,
silence
like,
with Dr.
I mean, and like, I see it. I mean, it's like if I look at, what are the resiliency factors for people who go online? You know, we're looking at, a secured attachment style, someone who's attached to more than themselves and machine, the capacity to connect to something that's bigger than you and I. So how does a machine do that? Because that is a resiliency. Yeah, but when I look at the people that are more vulnerable, you know, the people that are more vulnerable online, or the people, you know, in with children, adults, who don't, for some reason, you know, have had a history of whether it's mental illness, disorganized attachment to, you know, other substances and any other. And what I see, the people that are more resilient have the capacity to have this, what I call mindsight, the capacity to observe their own minds and others.
Can you tell the list, what is mindsight? I don't know if you've heard of this term. Dr. Rivera, could you please, what is mindsight? It's such a wonderful term.
Okay. Oh, I'm happy to say that. So I'm going to say thank you to Dr. Siegel, who developed this concept of mindsight. It's really our capacity to perceive our mind and our mind and others. You know, the capacity to be able to understand what's happening internally to us in the context of others in the moment. And that's a pretty sophisticated skill to have, and especially online, you know, when we're getting triggered.
Is mindsight a learned behavior? Is it something we practice, or do we come into this world with, boy, that Dr. Hawk guy, he's got pretty good mind. I mean, do we come into the world or is it something we work on and practice like baseball?
I think it's something we can practice. You know, there are some people who naturally, you know, have those abilities, but most of the time I think most of us have to practice it. That, you know, based on our histories, you know, many, you know, what you find is that you have individuals, and I will say this with a lot of our children, you know, there's a lot of history of neglect and trauma and attachment disconnection. So there are many of our kids and our adults are coming into the world, not only relating to people, you know, face to face, but online, where there have this, this vulnerability.
So those individuals, mm-hmm. whether it's psychopathology coming from a history of abuse, would we say that they have low mindsight or they don't have mindsight? So, I mean, do you know what I'm saying?
It depends on the person. I would say, you know, most individuals will probably have low mindsight unless that they're made aware, you know, through different practices, of course, like how to observe one's mind when they're actually getting triggered. You know, you're asking someone, whether it's in cyberspace or in person, and I'm going to talk about cyberspace, you're talking about someone who's getting triggered. And what I mean by triggered is that they're receiving something from the external world based on their perception that's quite alarming. So their stress response is going to get activated. Their, you know, the limbic system is going to get activated. So they're either going to fight, or flee, or they're going to freeze. What we're asking individuals to do is to, before they get into that response, is to understand, oh, I'm actually getting triggered here. I'm about to cascade into something that's not going to be good.
And that would be, because as Dr. I introduced the show, is the subconstruct of my predator is odor. Offline distress dictates online response, which basically means my offline world, depending how I feel, how I perceive, whether I'm in conflict, whether I'm bipolar, whatever it may be, directly influences my online world. So, for instance, if I'm a freshman in high school and I'm you know, let's say flat-chested, and I'm getting cyberbullied by my friends at school, both offline and online, about being flat-chested, well, within time, I naturally, because I feel a sense of less than, not accepted, and not feeling attractive, well, now I'm going to go into Snapchat, Keek, Instagram, and all the other adolescent social media sites, and I am going to be far more open to who? An online child predator who, and I know this, they actually can spot. They, you know, and I call it eye predator victim intuition, by that eye predators, some of them have the ability, not all, but some of them have the aptitude to be able to read your writing, look at your images, look at your content, and know whether or not you would be a good target. Well, under the construct of odor, if I feel less than, if I'm mad, I'm depressed, whatever it may be, and I'm, let's say, a child, it applies to adults too, when I go in cyberspace, that's going to manifest in the cyber world. And if I'm not mindful of it, so what you're saying is MindSight could be a way to lower that probability or reduce that of causing high-risk online behaviors.
Of course, you know, and it's so interesting, Michael, as you're saying that, is like the vulnerability that you talked about can go both ways. You can either be the perpetrator or the victim.
I never even thought about that. Yeah, you're right about the perpetrator.
Of course. You know, it's either, you know, and it depends, right? It depends on the, you know, what we're talking about, the level of resiliency with our children. And so they can go either way. You know, you have a child who has, for whatever reason, have their history of trauma or attachment trauma or any other mental conditions, and then you have the perfect storm of being online, and you get to fantasize, right? You get to fantasize. You get to have your altered ego. You get to project onto what you desire, which is typically against our, you know, the core wounding, which is whatever it is. It would typically is like, what, I'm not good enough. I'm not perfect enough. I'm not enough. And so many of our children who are so vulnerable can go either way. Right, and our adults too. So we're looking at perpetrators and victims, potentially.
But can it, can a child be taught MindSight? I mean, that to me is difficult, even for myself, who supposedly, you know, the cyber segment. For there's times when I go into cyberspace, you know, and trolls, we're not talking about trolls tonight, but anybody can Google troll triad to, you'll see it right on the top of Google to know what I'm talking about. There are times I think I try to practice MindSight. I don't call it MindSight, but I know eye predators, internet trolls, internet trolls specifically, they look to provoke, incite, and essentially, forgive my French, they look to piss off people randomly that they don't even know. I know that I've created a construct that includes interpret, but even though that is true, and I know this, and I spend my whole life in cyberspace, whether it's investigating, advising, you know, hunting, but there are times, Doc, where I can read something and I want to break a chair.
Of course, I do too. You know, that's all of us. We have that, you know, it's like in us. You know,
is that because MindSight is not, am I not practicing MindSight? Because I love the term.
Well, it depends, you know, what I would say is, you know, that if you're wanting to, when we think about MindSight, we think about how we, like, for example, you're saying you want to, you know, it's like when you have some certain reactions, you want to break a chair or just let someone have it. You know, it's right before, it's like understanding MindSight. It's not understanding our own behavior, but understanding the other person's behavior. And so it's like, I'm getting triggered, and they're to a level of trigger that I can talk about. And I can react in certain ways. I can either go on a roller coaster ride with it and go with it, right? And most of the time we do. This human tendency, we'll go with it. And sometimes we'll react to it. And then sometimes we will have our resiliency, our capacity to say, oh, there's something here that's not right, and I need to do something different.
Interesting. Dr. Ott, do you practice MindSight?
I can't say that I do because I've never heard of the term until just tonight.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, like I said, it's a new term to me that was introduced to me by Olga, so I'm fascinated with it. But let me ask you, Doc, when you go into cyberspace, however you do it, do you, is it checking myself? Am I saying, well, am I in a bad mood, good mood, neutral? No, that's not what MindSight is it?
It is. It's part of it. Part of it is knowing. Yeah, part of it is knowing what's my landscape? What's my internal landscape? How am I vulnerable? How am I triggered? You know, what would be the ways that I can get triggered? You know, of course, children, you know, and you were talking about children and their capacity to do that. They don't have the capacity to do that yet. So as adults, as parents, as educators, as professionals, we need to be educating our children how to do that. And so that is a pretty sophisticated skill. You know, so for me, if I'm going online, I'm looking at what am I doing, like what's my vulnerability right now? Am I triggered based on my history? Are there other factors as I'm going into the cyber world? Because that will certainly influence how I'm going to react to it. You know, I can say, the more vulnerable, and I will say this about clients that I've seen, children, adult, you know, teenagers and adults, the more vulnerable I go onto an online, social media, the more that I'm going to get triggered, the more that I will go with whatever fantasies or projections
yeah,
that I have.
Right. And we all have dark fantasies, hence dark psychology.
Oh, of course. And it goes both ways. I mean, I could be the victim or I can be the perpetrator.
Right, yeah, that's interesting. And the third, which you and I have discussed, is you could also be a bystander, because, you know, what I believe in any adversary relationship, at least in cyberspace, is that there's always an assailant, there's a target, there's that dance, but there's always, it seems, at least 100% of the people who call me, there's always a bystander and or bystanders. There's folks who know what's going on. You know, and there's research that with cyberbullying, which is a pediatric, you know, what kids do to each other, you know, they're already now saying 100% of all cyberbullying events, dynamics, include one and or more bystanders, which are kids that know that this is going on.
Of course. I mean, I hear this all the time. I mean, I have kids who are saying, oh, I felt so guilty. I felt so guilty watching this person, you know, my friend getting destroyed, and then I asked the question, why did you let it happen? Why did you observe and not do something about it? And ultimately they'll say, you know, I'm part of that community. I want to be part of it. I want, you know, we'll go back to neurobiologically, we want to be attached and attuned, and we'll do anything.
To be accepted, right? And to be recognized.
To be accepted and to be recognized. And sometimes that means doing something that's dark.
Yeah, well, that what you just said, because that falls in, because the research is saying now that bystanders, as it relates to the cyberbullying, is most times they don't intervene or do something because they fear one that the bully will then redirect their aggressions towards them.
Well,
and then obviously,
I mean, there's that issue, of course.
You know, and that, but also what walks hand in hand is if I take a stand, I stand up for the target, I confront the bully, is that now I won't be part of the group, I won't be part of the cool clique anymore, which is exactly what you're talking about.
Well, exactly. I mean, either I challenge, and if I challenge, the risk is I'm going to lose the community. And remember, back neurobiologically, we're attuned to connect in community, to connect to others, whether it is real and imagined. So if I am in imagining that you are my community, whether or not I have seen you, and then I am witnessing, right? I'm witnessing something that you're doing that maybe go against what I truly believe based on, you know, morals, values from my parents potentially. My pull will be, right? And I see this with our teenagers. My pull will be, I will connect with my peers. I'm going to connect even though there's a conflict there because I want to attach and attune. And, you know, then it creates cascades to a lot of complicated issues here.
Well, the dark side of cyberspace, and there's the whole, which is cyberpsych. Well, I mean, all psychology eventually all reality is going to have to, you know, accept that we live in the information age. And not that we have, and I tell people this all the time, because people always say to me, well, Dr. Nuge, what do you want us to do, turn off the internet? And obviously my retort is
no.
Information technology, the information age, you know, is part of us, and it's only going to become even more, you know, ingrained in us. Whether that's good or bad, I don't know. I can't get to the future yet. But until that day happens, it's accepting and being aware that there is this illusionary place called cyberspace. Cyberspace is defined as an abstract, artificial environment that is not real. Obviously, it's an electronic digital environment. But as the three of us know, and for the listeners, it is all one illusion. So that when you see somebody on a webcam, you talk to them on Skype, you read something, you may perceive it as real, perceptually, and, you know, not to get too Jungian, is many of us interpret it as reality, but in real reality, not to get as existentialist, we're communicating off a digital network, little electronic communications.